You're listening to There Ought to Be a Law, the Center for Auto Safety podcast with Executive Director Michael Brooks, Chief Engineer Fred Perkins, and hosted by me, Anthony Simino. For over 50 years, the Center for Auto Safety has worked to make cars safer. Good morning, listeners.
Good morning, world.
Entering a world without any regulations whatsoever. No seatbelts, airbags, gas mileage, tailpipe emissions, road lines, road dividers, stop signs, barriers. It's Elon's world now, and hopefully we can live in it. Hopefully. Anyway, let's get into whatever this is. I'm going to start off with this is kind of, you know, light. Is our friend Jonathan Gitlin over at Ars Technica had a review of the Hummer EV. Oh, my God. You know what? We love the Hummer EV. It's 9,000 pounds of mommy issues, is I think how we described it. But he has a good article on it. And my favorite part is his last two sentences. And I'm going to quote directly. It says, "But I think the biggest downside to driving the Hummer EV SUV were the looks I got from other people. The disapproving ones I could deal with. It was the thumbs up reactions that killed me inside each time."
That kills me too. I don't think I've seen an electric Hummer yet. I've seen Cybertrucks on a few occasions, and they seem to generate responses from drivers all around them. But the Hummer EV was the original poster child for one of our campaigns against these giant 9,000 pound trucks that are coming and driving on our road. So it's got a special place in our hearts here, although we think they should be eliminated.
Yeah, it's a fun little article. Check it out, because we have to move on with our lives.
I think he should have put another feature into his review, though. I'd like to see a tractor pull between this Hummer EV and a Cybertruck. You know, you've ever seen a tractor pull? They're very dramatic.
But, they are, but we know that the Cybertruck's back end will just tear off.
Well, that's a feature, but it would be fun to see.
I agree. So, hey, if you want to donate, what would that be? Like, that's like $250,000. Give us $250,000, then we can buy one of each of these and we'll tractor pull them.
And we'll do it in the Piggly Wiggly parking lot.
Okay, so we need more than $250,000 now because somebody's paying our bail.
Maybe they'd sponsor it.
Oh, my word. Okay, let's. I'm going to jump on to Zooks. Zooks. Yeah, remember Zooks, people? So this is interesting because Zooks is coming out with their autonomous vehicle, and they're like, hey, we don't need steering wheels and brake pedals and accelerators because we're living in the future where there's no regulations. What they claim for today is that, hey, we've self-certified. Most people that do this, they need an exemption from NHTSA. Hey, what's the death watch on NHTSA? God, I'm sorry. I'll try to be more positive. I'm trying here. From this article on The Verge, Zook contends that it won't need exemptions because it self-certifies that its vehicles meet current safety standards, minus a steering wheel and brake pedal and accelerator pedal. From the beginning, we've challenged ourselves to create a vehicle that would be compliant with federal motor vehicle safety standard requirements within the current regulatory structure. What? Wait, huh? How? Okay. So I get the whole self-certified nonsense thing. We've discussed this, but these guys are like, yeah, I know this is in the regulations, but we self-certify, we don't need it. Is that what they're doing?
Well, there's another quote in there that's pretty revealing. It says, quoting now, we've spent an incredible amount of money and time and people complying with the FMVSS regulations as they are, Levinson said. And because there aren't traditional manual controls, in some cases that requires, interpreting them in a way that's relevant to a robotaxi. So what he's saying here is that since there are no specific regulations concerning vehicles that don't have steering wheels, we can just go ahead and ignore the rest of them because, you know, it's difficult. And we've thought about it and we've tried a lot, but heck, we're just not going to do it. It's an interesting approach to regulations, exchanging aspirations for actual requirements. But I guess we've seen a lot of that in this industry, haven't we?
Yeah, this is kind of an open question here. NHTSA's had the Zoox petition, I believe, since earlier last year in 2023. And Zoox even wrote to NHTSA in November of 2022 saying, look, we are planning to do this type of certification, even though we know that autonomous vehicles, certain parts of them cannot be certified because a lot of the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards assume the presence of a human driver. It's just as part of the standard, it is assumed that there's going to be a driver in control of the vehicle in the driver's seat. And so the standards are written with that reference inherent to all the standards. And so you can't certify a vehicle to the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards if you are removing parts of the vehicle that are required if the vehicle is going to pass certain certification tests. And Zoox is essentially, their argument is, well, since we don't have a driver and we don't have to follow those references, essentially, I believe in one of their letters, they said, you know, we've even redesigned a couple of the tests to accommodate vehicles that don't have the components that are required by the Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, which essentially means they're creating their own test and passing their own test. But like I say, NHTSA's had this in front of them now for a year and a half and haven't made any determination on the matter, which is concerning and suggests that, you know, and especially with a new administration coming in that is probably not going to be holding Zoox's or any other autonomous vehicle manufacturer's feet to the fire. It's problematic, and it's problematic that the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, which are kind of the gold standard of what's expected out of companies when it comes to auto safety, are going to be able to be manipulated in this way.
So just to remind listeners, Zoox, because most of us are not familiar with it, they created a car that looks like a smaller minivan. It's a rectangle with tiny little tires that right now, I think Zoox is part of Amazon. They're letting only Amazon employees use it, and it goes, 25 miles per hour or something like that? Is that right? And it's just in limited areas. And okay, so that's Zoox. There's no app. You can't call it up unless maybe you're an Amazon employee. So Zoox is, they're doing their autonomous thing, and now they're getting into a cat fight with Tesla. And I don't know. I don't think it's going to work out too well for them now. But basically, the head of Zoox is saying, yeah, Tesla's full self-driving thing, it's not the right technology. It won't work. We've said that. We agree.
I mean, they're basically saying what you've probably heard us say many times. I mean, he's saying that Tesla's camera-based full self-driving doesn't have the software necessary to keep people safe, and also touching on the fact that the systems can lull drivers into a false sense of complacency before the systems do the wrong thing and put you in danger as a human. But basically, it's the CTO and founder of Zoox came out and said, you know, our perspective is you really do need significantly more hardware than Tesla is putting in their vehicles to build a robo-taxi that is not just as safe, but as especially safer than a human. So Zoox is targeting a good thing, which is not just a software and hardware combination that equals, you know, the rather bad stats we see on our roads. You know, 1.3 deaths for every 100 million miles or so is kind of the average driver benchmark. Zoox is at least targeting, you know, something safer than a human, which is what we all want. And after that happened, you know, Elon came out and badmouthed Zoox, saying that his company got bailed out by Amazon. Elon's been the recipient of at least one bailout that I'm aware of. So, you know, it's glass houses and all that. But
he wasn't building a glass house.
Yeah. in this fight, you know, we're firmly on Zooks' side, even though we think their plans for the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards are their own version of corrupt.
Yeah. Elon saying, yeah, you've gotten bailed out by Amazon is hilarious, considering all of his businesses are built on the U.S. taxpayer. Like, you got bailed out by Jeff. I got bailed out by Uncle Sam repeatedly. But hey, that's just a bunch of billionaires fighting each other. It doesn't have anything to do with you or me, except when they put cars on the highway that are unsafe. But hey, if you want to help make cars safer, donate to autosafety.org. Wait, what? The Center for Auto Safety. Donate to the Center for Auto Safety. You can go to autosafety.org and you can donate. And Fred's laughing at me right now. And that's why we don't have a video version of the show.
I think some of us were up late last night. I'm guessing about that.
No, I went to sleep early and woke up to panic.
I mean, given the last few elections, the staying up to watch hasn't really been as productive as it was in the past when you don't really have an answer. But I guess this year was different. But I did not stay up late watching returns. I didn't expect to have an answer this soon, but here we are.
All right. I'm going to go a little off topic then. It's still in our wheelhouse, but it's not in our notes. So the new administration moving in, and I'm not keeping this really political, they are very anti-regulation. They think regulations are dumb and stupid, and they want to get rid of a whole bunch of government agencies because they don't understand what they do. If I don't understand it, let's get rid of it. So I'm thinking, does NHTSA have a chance of surviving in the future?
Well, NHTSA's going to survive as an organization. I mean, we've kind of seen a blueprint. I mean, we've seen the blueprint for what a Trump administration does at NHTSA 8 years ago or so when that started. And essentially, you're going to see a NHTSA that is incredibly hesitant to do any type of rulemaking. You know, we know that the Trump administration and Republicans in general are anti-regulatory. Well, NHTSA is a regulatory agency. They don't want NHTSA rulemakings making it down the pipe. So in the last Trump administration, I think we saw two final rules that, you know, regulations that actually reached the finish line and applied to the auto industry. They were very minor rules, while we've seen, you know, dozens of proposed and final rules presented by the current NHTSA administration. There's a huge concern on the rulemaking side. That's the thing that is most impacted by a change in administration over at NHTSA. We also have concerns, you know, since supposedly Elon Musk is going to be taking a role as the government efficiencies are, or whatever they're calling it. You know, we have serious concerns for a lot of things going over at NHTSA. The investigations that are currently ongoing into Tesla is a significant concern of how fairly those are going to be carried out. Also, the standing general order, which the current administration's NHTSA put into place in 2021, I believe, that collects data on all of the partial automation and fully automated crashes. That was created by administrative fiat, essentially. So it's not a law, it's not a regulation, and the next group coming in could eliminate that data collection, which has proven critical in getting recalls in, you know, dozens of cases. So we're concerned about that. Very concerned about that as a result of this election. And beyond that, you know, when you look at the composition of the Congress, the Senate is now Republican controlled, and the House, I believe, is still somewhat in the mix, and we're not aware of any results there. But the chances for really bad consumer legislation, bad legislation for consumers regarding autonomous vehicles, I mean, there's a really good chance that's going to start pretty soon here. I mean, we've had a mix of control in the presidency and Congress for years now, and so it's been difficult for the AV companies and their lobbyists to advance this legislation. But if the House ends up going Republican, it's probably going to be something we're going to see in the very near future, is an autonomous vehicle bill that, you know, essentially paves the way for bad technology to be put on our roads without proper testing for safety before it's released. So we have a lot of concerns about safety given the results we've seen in the past 24 hours.
We're all gonna die. Yeah. Okay. So, well, Elon's gonna be the efficiency czar appointed by off-Broadway Mussolini. That's sad because, you know, Tesla has this feature called Summon, or what is it? What are they called now? Real Summon?
Smart Summon.
Smart Summon. And this is just a dumb demo feature they've sold to people. And it allows you to remotely get your car delivered to you, like from a parking lot and whatnot. And it doesn't really, it kind of works, I guess, maybe. Well, one guy, he's like, hey, I got a really tight parking spot. I'm going to park it there. Like, it's a spot where there's houses on both sides and you can't get in there. So, but he's been using this feature to park his car there and have his car come out, and his car comes out so he can actually open the doors and get in it. Well, Tesla updated their software, and now this poor guy can't get his car because the Tesla software is saying, yeah, it's not safe. There's buildings around us. We can't move. We're stuck here. What do you want from us?
The guy he's essentially stuck in an alley that's narrow. He can't open the car doors to get into his vehicle and move the vehicle manually. And he parked it there using the Smart Summon feature, which was updated. And I'm presuming here, the article is not clear and it's unclear, but I'm presuming what happened with Smart Summon was it was using two different systems to function. It was using the Tesla's vision system, their much touted vision system, but also it was using sensors that were embedded in the vehicle, that basic ultrasonic sensors that detect objects that are nearby. It looks like in this guy's case, he parked it, and when he parked it, it was using the software version with the ultrasonic sensors. And then when he went back out to retrieve it, it was using the vision only system. And now the Tesla vision only system can't see its way out of a tight box. And so his car is stuck there, until he gets some help. You know what, looking at the picture of it though, I think there's a good case to be made that he could climb in a window of that vehicle. But,
well, the guy, he climbed in through the trunk and pushed the seats down. That's how he managed to get into the car, get it out. And
yeah,
he hasn't been a contortionist for years, so he had to really limber up first.
Yeah, I mean, I would call this an edge case problem, even that folks probably overuse. This isn't something that most owners of this are going to have to worry about, but it does point out, you know, a problem with using a vision system only for detecting obstacles around the vehicle.
Everything is perfect. You don't understand. It's the best ever. No? Okay. Hey, how about some gaslighting? Do we have any gaslight subjects? Fred, I know you've got one. You always come prepared. You always do your homework. He's sitting in the front of the classroom, his hand raised. Ooh, pick up me.
No, please. I was in the back making the animal noises.
Well, that was just you're tall and you have digestion issues.
That was me. Okay. Well, I do have a gaslight for this week. At least I think I do. So there was an article on about EREVs, or extended range electric vehicles. And I'm not sure if this was a gaslight so much as a really lousy reporting job. But anyway, I'll tell you what it's about. They were talking about the, EREVs might prove less emissions intensive than their PHEV cousins, because drivers cannot simply choose to skip charging and driving gasoline unknown. Well, I don't know why not, because what this EREV is all about is basically a plug-in hybrid vehicle with a larger battery. And they then use the internal combustion engine to produce a small amount of power to drive the car when it's in normal operation. Now, the reason this works is because when you're driving a car down the highway, you're only using 20 or 30 horsepower, well, unless you're in one of the Hummer EVs, in which case you're using, you know, 50 or 60 horsepower. But anyway, if you've got that small amount of power coming into the battery as electric power, then you're basically just only using the battery, the large battery, to go up and down uphills and to recover energy. So that's, you know, that's the standard approach that cars, the big engines, use now. They use a small amount to go down the road, and then they use the rest of the engine to accelerate and to go up and go up hills when you need extra power. So this reporter makes a lot of questionable statements here, and
fake news.
Well, maybe so, but a couple of things. One is they assume that because there's an electric power source, it's going to be inherently more efficient than an internal combustion engine that produces the same amount of power. That's simply not true, because somehow you have to get electricity into the vehicle. Now, if you happen to live in an area with hydropower or solar power that's going into the utility stream, then when you charge your car, you are in fact saving some carbon. But if you're in what almost all of us live in, which is a utility district where most of the power is produced by combustion, then really it's much harder to make the case that you're saving the earth or reducing the overall carbon footprint by using an electric vehicle. Because at each stage in the chain, when you convert energy from one form to another, you do not have 100% efficiency, and there are losses associated with it. But anyway, this reporter says that that's absolutely fine. The extender will increase the vehicle's range from about 350 to 500 miles. And an EREV is more efficient than a gas-powered vehicle because the gas is powering an electric propulsion system, which wastes less energy than a gas engine. Wrong. Because in this case, the electric power is basically trying to replace a mechanical transmission. Mechanical transmissions are very, very efficient. So really, you'd have to make the statement that an electric motor is more efficient than a gear-driven transmission, and that's simply not true. So I'm giving them either a Razzie Award for making just bad reporting or promoting it through gaslight illumination. If this particular publication, which is called Wired, has some agenda that they're trying to hide by putting out bad information.
You should have started off saying it was from Wired. I could have taken a nap and ignored you.
Didn't you do that anyway, Anthony?
No, I paid attention. I was like, maybe something good is Wired.
I actually like Wired. I don't know.
Oh, God. Yeah, my gaslight choice this week is Wired. Just everything since like 1996. No, it's the American public. You disappointed me. You're just, this is just a prank, right? The voting with this is just a prank, right? Right? You're gaslighting me. No? Okay, it's Kathy Wood. Sorry.
I can't joke about it yet. Maybe in a year.
Yeah, I'm taking a week off from gaslighting. I feel gaslit.
So you have nothing to add to this, Michael?
No.
Very firm no. Okay, well, I'm going to actually say it's the modern headlight. That's it. I've talked about this before on the show. What? Why? It's not my gaslight, really, but we're going to talk about this.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so look, headlights, I've talked about this. I think drivers are out there trying to kill me. They're shooting their lights at me. I can't see at night. They're shooting their lights into the back of my car. The lights keep getting brighter. It's awful. The kids are walking across my lawn. This is ridiculous. Okay. There's an article we're linking to from The Guardian, and it's talking about basically people saying, hey, these new lights, these new LED lights are really bright and what have you. Whereas AAA says, hey, we actually need more light on the road. And that the issue is more of that it's many vehicles on the road have misaligned headlights. Over time, the regular wear and tear of driving can jostle headlights out of alignment, meaning the brightest part of the light ends up illuminating Anthony's eyeballs, and it's not supposed to. One NBC News report found that only 15 states require annual or biennial passenger vehicle inspections, and only 10 of those check headlight alignment. Michael, you have something you'd like to say.
Well, there's a lot on this subject. I could probably have based a gaslight on some of the commenters in this article. But, you know, what AAA is saying is right. I mean, we need more light on the roads. One of the, you know, a lot of our traffic deaths and the majority of them occur at night and occur primarily due to poor visibility, among other things, the usual suspects, you know, drinking and speeding and all that. But poor visibility plays a major role in that. And there has been, you know, a large number of people since, I would say, since LED lights have become commonplace, but also since vehicles have grown in size and stature, we have headlights in our face a lot more, because more likely than not, you're going to have, if you're driving a sedan especially, you're going to have a large truck behind you with headlights that are beaming directly into your rearview mirror, directly into your eyes. That's part of the issue. There are groups that want to blame LEDs specifically for the issue. They make a lot of health and safety claims around LEDs that are unverified and get a lot of media attention somehow, despite their unverified claims. They claim that there's a safety issue, but to date, I haven't seen any evidence of crashes that have been caused by lights that are too bright, while there are thousands every year that are caused by not having enough light. So there's an anti-LED movement afoot that is behind a lot of these stories, and they should probably get my gaslight of the week. But there's some other things as well. This, you know, we only have 15 states with state safety inspections, as the article notes, and only 10 of those measure headlights. And Lord knows how accurate their measurements are. We also have millions of non-compliant lights being sold to Americans through eBay and Amazon, and coming from China. And who knows, you know, we know that these lights are not, you know, all they claim to be certified to Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards. They're not. And we've heard from many people in the parts industry saying they're testing these lights on their own and they're not compliant with motor vehicle safety standards. And people are buying these at their local auto shop as well, installing them improperly. I mean, there are literally a dozen reasons why vehicles can glare you out of your seat at night. I've certainly had that experience. And I understand it can be a momentary distraction. It can be very annoying to have someone shining brights into your face. But like I say, we just haven't seen the data that suggests that there is a real safety problem here that's contributing to crashes. So one thing we can all look forward to, I think, is the advent of adaptive driving beam technology in America that will allow for better control of where the light that's being produced by our headlamps goes. You know, it can be directed around corners. It can be directed in a way that would not obscure the vision of drivers of other vehicles. I mean, that's all possible in the future. This is probably a Pitts bad moment, as Fred would say, but maybe I'm hoping that LED lights and adaptive driving beam technology can resolve a lot of this for people. It also wouldn't help if we could drive smaller cars where headlights aren't constantly being aimed into our faces.
Well, there's another factor here, which is that the optics are better for LEDs than they were for incandescent lights. If you remember the old days with incandescent lights, there'd be a fuzzy spot that is the high beam focus area or the low beam focus area. But now with LEDs, because the light source is actually very small, you can have very good optics on it. And you may have noticed that the LED projection has a very hard edge to it. So,
yes, in my eyeball.
In your eyeball sometimes. But you know, it's either really bright or not bright at all. And so when you've tuned the optics so that the low beam top edge is parallel to the plane of the car, right? So it's just going straight ahead, not up, which is what the high beams do. But if it's just going straight ahead, as soon as the car goes over a bump or something, then that hard edge of the focus area moves up into your line of vision. So that's that's a consequence of the fact that you do have better optics associated with LEDs. That's not going to go away with adaptive lighting, because the reason you can make the adaptive lighting work is because you've got this hard edge and you've got the optics associated with it. So this is not something that's going to go away. And the other factor is, of course, that the front ends of a lot of pickup trucks and SUVs now are just getting higher and higher. So as you get close to the back of your car, even though they have the high beams on, what is straight ahead to the driver of that vehicle is in your rearview mirror, because you're driving a smaller vehicle. So those are all factors.
It's because I'm in a tiny car that I have to be subject to these big, bad LED bullies.
Yep, shame on you.
Damn it. Okay. Because I was told...
I may not be sensitive enough to people who have light sensitivity issues. I don't, so this isn't something I experience a lot. But it seems like there, in the article for sure, there are people who are much more susceptible to problems there. So perhaps, I'm being a little too harsh on them, but I see the lives saved by good lighting as outweighing some of the light sensitivity problems as a whole. It's one of those safety trade-offs that is made every day in the industry, and that really have to be made to reduce the number of crashes we see on the road.
Part of the article, and I think this is my issue that I have with it, I don't care what the technology is behind it, except that I was told by RFK Jr. that LEDs, they'll put vaccines inside your body, and he told him that by a tape arm in his brain. Let's all wave our head to the new homeopathic FDA.
Oh man, it's going to be bad.
Let's remove fluoride from the water. Anyway, but part of the article they talked about, and I think this is the issue I have, it's talking about that incandescent halogen bulbs, the halogen were the predecessors to LEDs after incandescence. They emitted a light that has a light orange or red hue, which is gentle on the eye, whereas LEDs tend to emit a harsh white light. And I think that's the problem I have with it, is the frequency of the light and the bouncing in my face, and I'm in a small car. So, Fred, maybe this is a technical question for you. I don't know if you can answer it, but if you say it with enough confidence, I'll believe you. Can't we tune an LED to change the temperature of the light coming out of it?
Sure, but that's not going to solve your problem. This is a problem of intensity, not of color.
No, I think the temperature. I think definitely. It's you tune it down, you add a little more yellow into it, a nice cerulean blue, a happy little tree.
Okay, recreational drugs can do that for you, so try that out sometime.
Don't try.
I don't think that that's the problem. The problem is just the fundamental optics associated with it. And, the fact is that when you're in front of a car and that car behind you goes over a speed bump, even though it has the slow beams on, you're going to get zapped by that light. Color may make it a little better, but, you'd have to go to red to really not impact your night vision. And nobody's going to put a red light on it. And I'm here to tell you, because I've tried it, that if you look at an intense red light that is bright enough to let you actually walk around or navigate, you're going to get a pretty good eye zap.
Oh, hey, listeners, if you think Fred's right, donate $100. If you think Anthony's right, donate $101. If you think Michael's right, donate $102. And then we'll figure out who's right. That's right. Donate $100 if you think Fred's right, $101 if you think Anthony's right, and $102 if you think Michael's right.
I'm voting for Anthony. I'm voting for Anthony just because he slipped in a Bob Ross reference.
Yeah, there we go. And speaking of Bob Ross, Fred, can you enlighten us with your Tao this week?
You've now entered the Bob Tao Ross? Fred.
Bob, he's the PBS painter guy.
I don't know anything about that.
Huh. Weird.
But okay, so I've been asked to make people understand EREVs this week. So EREV is extended range electric vehicle. Fundamentally, it's a marketing term that's being associated with plug-in hybrid cars that have a larger battery than the plug-in hybrid cars you can buy today. This has started in China, and it is responding to the fact that people don't like the idea that they can be stranded in the middle of nowhere when their battery goes dead. So this innovation, such as it is, puts an internal combustion engine in the train, so it recharges your battery and takes over essentially for the power requirements when you're going down the road at normal speeds. Now, remember, if you have a 500 horsepower pickup truck, well, good for you. But almost all the time when you're driving in a pickup truck, you're hauling around 470 horsepower's worth of junk and using 30 horsepower to drive down the highway. Yeah, there are circumstances when you're going to use more, but that's the basic idea behind this. So what the EREV does is they replace that 20 horsepower, 30 horsepower draw that normally has to go to keeping your car moving with an internal combustion engine. So it just reduces the duty cycle on the battery. And because it reduces the duty cycle on the battery, of course, you get a more extended range. Now, this means that your vehicle will run out of fuel in 500 miles rather than 350 miles. And if that's, you know, good enough for you, then that's good. There are a couple of design options, though. One is that the EREV can have enough power, the internal combustion engine can have enough power to recharge your battery, which is what you see with a plug-in hybrid, or that it does not, which would mean that it's extending the range of the vehicle, but you're still dependent on plugging the car in from time to time. So we don't know which is going to win with that. My guess is that people liking the independence from the recharging capability will probably go with a slightly larger engine so you can recharge the battery on the fly, similar to the way a plug-in hybrid works now. But we'll just have to see what that happens. So anyway, that's the term, extended range electronic electric vehicle. It's a plug-in hybrid with a bigger battery, and it is available now, apparently, or soon will be, through Volkswagen subsidiary Scout, which could have been my Gaslight Illumination, I guess. They've appropriated the, or they bought the name Scout, and they're promoting it as an all-American solution to the electric SUV problem, when in fact it's a German company that is doing that. So maybe that'll be a future Gaslight. Who knows? Anyway, that's the EREV story. Any questions about that?
So it sounds like it is just marketing nonsense.
It is marketing nonsense, to the extent that marketing is nonsense, but
well, it's distinct from hybrid vehicles in that the gas powered portion of it is not contributing to the movement of the wheels, just to the charging of the battery. Is that right?
Well, that's what some people would assert, but hybrid vehicle only means that you've got both the gas power and electric power that are associated with the motive, with driving the car forward. Like the light hybrids we've talked about from time to time, they provide electric power, but it goes through the engine and transmission to drive the wheels. But there are other hybrid vehicles that are strictly electric drive.
Right.
But they also have an internal combustion engine. So the distinction that part of the motive power goes directly from the engine to the drive wheels through mechanical transmissions versus electric power going to the drive wheels is something people might promote, but that's not a unique aspect of the hybrid vehicle or the extended range electric vehicle.
That's interesting. It makes me wonder if this is a marketing, just a marketing scam, or also something that might allow these vehicles to qualify for, you know, tax credits that a hybrid might not be able to as well.
Well, that the latter consideration, I don't know. But the marketing aspect of this is pretty clear to me. Now, it doesn't mean necessarily it's a bad idea. It probably is, because of waste of resources, but you know, it may help people sell some more cars.
Well, it's the new undercoating.
Yeah, but if you're one of the people who believes that an electric propulsion system is inherently much more valuable and sanctified than an internal combustion engine, then this would be clearly good for you. But I think people have to recognize that a 9,000 pound Hummer electric vehicle is not inherently more efficient than a 50 horsepower moped or 5 horsepower moped, right? There are scaling effects associated with these electric vehicles. And the fact is that you've somehow got to come up with the electricity to just stuff into the battery in the first place. If you're burning coal to do that, you really have only marginal benefits associated with a carbon footprint from the electric vehicle.
I don't think you're going to like the next 4 years, Fred, with that attitude. Okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's going to be fun.
Okay. So let's get into a serious conversation here. Okay. Look, enough of this. Which side of the car should your fuel filling hole be on? Your fuel door hole being on? There's an article in Jalopnik where apparently people with way too much time on their hands argue about this stuff. And it's saying, oh, should it be on the driver's side? Should it be on passenger side? Now, the article is interesting. It starts up and says the right answer is the middle of the car, but apparently that's illegal. I remember as a kid, it was awesome. Like, you'd lower the license plate and you'd get the gas thing in there. And I think like a Chevy Caprice, maybe. I don't know what it was. Chevy something.
There were a lot of cars that used to have that.
Why don't they do that anymore? I love that.
I was actually, you know, I was struggling to find a site to where it's actually, you know, banned to have a fuel filler in the center rear of the vehicle. I don't think there is such a law or regulation, but what I do think is that, you know, NHTSA increased FMVSS 301 is NHTSA's fuel safety regulation. It covers, you know, fuel tanks and fuel fillers and lines. And They increased the speeds at which that test was conducted in the 90s, I believe, and again in the 2000s. And the rear, they increased the rear crash test on that. I think it's virtually impossible or really difficult to pass muster on the certification test if you have a rear fuel filler location. So I think that's the reason for that. But, you know, the article, it's interesting when you're talking about, you know, safety considerations on the left side of the car or the right side of the car. I mean, if you're putting a fuel filler door on the right side of the car, then, you know, the guy in the YouTube video that accompanied the article, the very over-caffeinated young man who was debating all sides of this topic, you know, suggests that there is a safety reason for that. If you run out of gas on the highway when you're refilling your tank with your portable gas can, then you don't have to stand on the roadside of the highway to refill it. Now, again, I'll bring the word edge case up. That's a rare scenario. People don't run out of gas all that often, but it does happen. And when it does, you probably want them to be safe. You know, on the left side of the vehicle, I think the real argument there is for convenience. There wasn't really any safety reason that I could come up with to put a fuel filler on the left side, other than the fact that you don't have to walk around your car to fill your gas tank. You know, and I think as it turned out, it looked like we're a country with about 65% of our cars having a left side fuel filler and 35% on the right. My Volkswagen has it on the right. How about you?
Mine's on port. It's on the left side, Fred.
I'm starboard.
You're still really in a Subaru. I figured all the Japanese, maybe they all kept it left.
I think it's, I don't know, it's starboard.
Fred doesn't even know.
Fred doesn't know.
Oh, I do. I've fueled up my car many times.
Have you? Don't you have your butler fuel it for you? Let me try that again.
My butler won't do that.
That's too bad.
They have no organic chemicals clause in the contract.
Let's jump into recalls. And hey, I'm guessing in a year we'll never do recalls again because...
You're very, very, very negative.
I apologize, listener.
Recalls are going to continue to happen. Maybe not at the rate they should, but...
But they'll never include Tesla again. Anyway, let's start off with Nissan. 4,036 vehicles. This is the 2023 to 2024 Nissan Z. Some components names, and the components names, I'll just help you out here. Horn, corner, sensor. This is around the front bumper issue. A Nissan tech identified an incorrect diagnostic trouble code when the right-hand pedestrian collision detection centers of the front bumper harness were disconnected. What?
Okay, I want to talk about this. This is actually a good feature. So the pop-up pedestrian safety hood releases the hinge at the back of the hood and causes it to move away from the engine components. So it turns it into essentially a relatively soft springboard. So when you hit a pedestrian, the electronic sensor causes the hinge to relax in the back and pushes the hood up so that when the pedestrian falls over the hood, they don't hit the hard components in the engine. So it reduces thoracic and cervical and head injuries. So the recall is important, but this is actually a good feature and good for Nissan for putting it to their vehicles.
Yeah, this is required in Europe, but not America, these types of pedestrian protection measures and hoods. And quite frankly, Nissan didn't have to perform this recall. I mean, it's not violating a federal motor vehicle safety standard, and it's not an unreasonable risk to safety in the sense that, most cars out there don't have this technology in America. So like Fred said, good on Nissan for getting this fixed and making their cars safer for pedestrians via recall.
Hey, good job, Nissan. Next up, Chrysler, 33,777 vehicles, the 2025 Ram 1500 pickup truck. They're violating FMVSS 57.126, blah, blah, blah. The escape system, the ESC, what?
That's the electronic stability control system. So there's a fault in the system, and that's bad. Yes, the electronic stability control is required. The recall is about an encoder ring, something I'm not real familiar with. I'm familiar with decoder rings that used to
Captain
cereal
Crunch.
Boxes.
Sorry, so let me jump in here. Okay?
There we go.
In order for the electronic stability control to work, or actually for the braking system to work properly, anti-lock braking system to work properly, you have to know what the speed of the individual tires on the vehicle is. So what this sensor does is it sends an electronic signal to the vehicle controller that lets the controller know exactly what the rotational speed of the individual tires is. And what the electronic stability control does is it looks at all the tires when your car is in a critical configuration, or it's going to flip over, or it's going to swerve, or whatever, and it individually controls braking on each of the tires to bring your car back into a stable, safe configuration. Okay, so this is a critical component that allows the vehicle controller to know what the speed of each individual tire is. Okay, so that's where this comes from. And so when I say encoder, what it does is basically it encodes the rotational speed of each individual tire or each individual wheel so that the stability control can work.
Very neat. Okay. Well, if you're a customer of one of these vehicles, Chrysler will fix it for you and they'll reimburse you for any issues you have with it, according to this, because they have a history of reimbursing their customers. Who've already paid for the cost of repairing this problem. So get that one done. Yeah.
That should be out around the middle of December is when owners will start to know about that. But be aware that in the meantime, your electronic stability control system may not work as expected. So stay stable.
Stay stable. Up next, General Motors, 107 vehicles. That is very specific. The 2020 to 2022 Chevrolet Bolt EV, which people seem to really like. Service records were determined to determine vehicles that may not have successfully completed installation of the advanced diagnostic software as related to another recall. Wait, so these cars got recalled, and then some of them, I guess they just unplugged it before the update was completed.
Yeah, yeah, it looks like they figured out that some of the vehicles that, you know, this was a recall. I think this was the fire recall for the Bolts where owners waited quite some time for a fix. And then looks like about a little over 100 of the owners that waited all that time for a fix didn't actually get the fix. It looks like I don't think there was an incident that caused this, that someone's vehicle caught on fire, but it looks like they noticed it and found all these vehicles through service records. So that's good news. And owners who are having this issue, the 107 of you out there who got a bad software update on that initial recall, should hear from them in a little over a month.
All right. In the meantime,
I would say, you know, I think there was a park outside associated with that recall. So you should continue to park your vehicle outside until you get this recall fixed for the owners affected here.
Hey, I want to go back to electronic stability control for just 1 second.
You're living
This is a wonderful innovation by the industry. I mean, these things are great. So let me give you a couple examples. I was on the Beltway in Washington, driving, minding my own business, when traffic was backed up to get onto I-66 when it had a left exit. And, you know, it always backed up for miles. So I was going along at highway speed. All of a sudden, one gentleman who was queued up to get onto I-66 decided he'd rather do something else. And so about 10 feet in front of me, all of a sudden he pulled into the traffic lane right ahead of me. I was driving an Isuzu Trooper at the time. So I cranked over the wheel. The car started to flip. It didn't flip, but it started to roll over. So I was glad to get it under control. I may have offered a famous salute to the driver, but I'm not sure. Then I bought a Subaru and I was driving back from Annapolis to Washington at highway speed. All of a sudden, a big lump of metal fell off a tow truck that was ahead of me. And so I once again had to crank the wheel over to get out of the way of that object. And, you know, it was just stunning because the car was stable. The ESC kicked in. I steered away from this large object, whatever the hell it was, and went on my merry way. So this is a wonderful system. Thank you to industry for developing this. This is the kind of electronic innovation that we would like to see more of. And, you know, we'd like to see people stop concentrating on automatic vehicles and putting more and more of this really excellent life-saving technology into vehicles that are currently being offered to the public. End of rant.
But electronic stability control is not a required feature.
It is. It is.
It is now. Okay, good. That's what I thought. Okay, moving on. Mazda, 80,915 vehicles. The 2024 Mazda CX-90, the 2025 CX-70. This is old. Can I say this is part of the backup camera thing, kind of, sort of? Multiple warning messages. Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, the 360 view monitor is affected by this one. So it affects the backup camera's function as well as numerous other things, including anything on your instrument cluster, seatbelt warnings, defroster, engine warning light, high voltage battery cooling system, all sorts of things. So this electrical issue is big.
Come get that fixed. Last recall, Ford. 6,212 vehicles. Wait a second. Ford, I understand being in the recall roundup, but only 6,000 vehicles? Come on. They're always like 600,000 vehicles. So this is the 2024 Ford Mustang, the gas version, and it has a problem with its instrument panel cluster. May not illuminate at startup or during a drive cycle. It's a drive cycle. So basically, I guess their screen just stays black, and you're like, I'm going this. Yeah, I'm going fast, slow, brakes on. I don't know. What is it? What is a drive cycle? Does that mean just you're driving the car?
Yeah, that just means you start, you go somewhere, and then you stop. That's the drive cycle.
Oh, that's not that exciting.
Yeah, it's exciting if you don't have an instrument panel, though, and not in a good way. So that's something, you know, it's just yet another software issue in vehicles. What they're going to do here is basically update your instrument panel cluster software. And owners should be hearing about this one starting next week. So get ready to take your car in for that software update if you own a 2024 Mustang.
Oh, that's exciting. And with that, listeners, have you gone to autosafety.org and clicked on the donate button? Come on, do it, do it, do it. We need your help more than ever. Thanks for listening. Tell all your friends. Until next time. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
For more information, visit www.autosafety.org.